I'm Dr. John LaPook, chief medical correspondent for CBS News. As the song says, you gotta have heart. But for a long time, this essential organ remained a mystery. In a new book, Texas Monthly's executive editor and two-time National Magazine Award winner, Mimi Swartz, shows just how hard it is to create one of nature's most fascinating creations in her new book, Ticker: The Quest to Create an Artificial Heart. And Mimi joins me today from Houston, Texas. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Now, we were just chatting before the podcast began, and you said that this is kind of like the right stuff for the heart instead of for the space effort. What do you mean by that?
Yes. Well, what I mean is I didn't write this book because I love homework. What drew me to this book were several characters who are on the verge of being lost to history, but who are really pioneers in the world of heart surgery. And what I didn't realize was that heart surgery is very modern. It really only started after World War II. So the early heart surgeons were very much like the early astronauts. No one, maybe even freer, because no one was really looking over their shoulders and no one really knew what they were doing. So they tried a lot of very interesting, innovative things before they figured out how to operate on the heart.
And I was reading your descriptions. Sometimes they got permission. Sometimes they didn't get permission. I remember that Keith Reemsma, who was a cardiac surgeon from Columbia Presbyterian. He was one of my mentors, and he said, it's better to beg forgiveness than ask permission.
Yes, this was a motto among the Texas surgeons and probably, I think, all the early heart surgeons. I mean, Christian Barnard, who did the first transplant, didn't have to wait around to determine brain death, which is why he did the first instead of these American surgeons who are desperate to be the first.
Of course, he was in South Africa, right?
He was in South Africa.
And this was when?
Even prior. That was 1968.
So that happened, and I remember the hubbub that came around. What do you mean? You put one person's heart in another person's chest?
Yeah.
What are you talking about?
What I remember, unfortunately, I also remember that period very well. And
or fortunately that you're around to remember
yes,
it. Let's look at the
yes.
bright side. Not that you're so old.
And I'm healthy. But, you know, the hubbub was similar to what's happened with artificial hearts. But in both cases, well, with transplants, it was, oh, my God, what happens if you put a man's heart in a woman? Will she turn into a man? And, of course, there was a lot of racism. Well, you couldn't possibly put a black person's heart in a white person. And with a mechanical heart now, I think people are
add that was disproven just before going on to the mechanical heart.
Good idea. Yes. Yeah. People don't even, they're pretty much exactly the same after a transplant.
And now transplants gotten, almost routine, right? I mean, it's still kind of amazing.
Yeah.
It's a miracle. I had a patient who collapsed in Italy on a biking trip.
Oh.
Actually, it was only about 9 days later that he was able to get a heart that was available to him. And that's because in Italy, they have you have to opt out of wanting to be a donor.
Oh, that's brilliant.
So in the United States, of course, you have to opt in, and the average wait is several hundred days. So, these early operations, it may seem now they're routine. Everybody does them. You get a heart transplant. You have some medicine to stop rejection from happening because it's a foreign object that's in your body. But at the very beginning, it was like the bravest person was the first person to eat an egg. Now we eat eggs. It's like, who was that first person? The first person to actually do that transplant. Tell us a little bit about that Christian Barnard's action there and the hubbub that it did that ensued.
Well, when he did it, it was seen as this miracle, and it was supposed to open a new door in the world of curing heart disease. But then what happened, and subsequently the doctors who had been waiting in line in America quickly, I think, lobbied some fellows at Harvard to come up with a different definition of brain death so that they could start operating.
They could harvest
donor hearts and do transplants. But then what happened was everybody died. And then it was thought, well, transplants were this crazy idea because no one was surviving. And it was only when they realized that the problem was they had to suppress, you correct me, they had to suppress the
immune response.
The immune system, yeah, with a drug called cyclosporin. Right.
And that was a turning point.
It took quite a while. That was the real turning point.
Now, at the same time, there's all this drama going on, and it's all throughout your book. It's really interesting to hear the nitty gritty. It's like a modern day. It's like a soap opera between Michael DeBakey and Denton Cooley, these two hotshot cardiac surgeons in Texas, in Houston, right? And the two of them were there was this huge rivalry, like with Michelangelo and Leonardo da Vinci. These two great people at the same time, but they really weren't the best of friends. Tell us about that.
Well, what happened was DeBakey was at the time probably one of the most famous people in the world. It was a slightly different value system then when doctors were celebrities, and heart doctors in particular were the most famous celebrities. So Dr. DeBakey was on the cover of Time, on television all the time, a virtual extension of the presidency in terms of advising on healthcare. And he had hired a very handsome young doctor named Denton Cooley, who also, been to Hopkins, worked on very inventive surgeries. And Cooley started to, I think, overshadow him. And DeBakey didn't like it. And they were both at Baylor Medical School at the time. And as the relationship deteriorated, Cooley became aware that DeBakey had someone working on an artificial heart in his lab. And Cooley, by that time, had enough contempt for DeBakey to determine that DeBakey was never going to use this heart in his mind. So he got together with the inventor of this heart and said, well, why don't we try and put it in somebody? And that's what they did without DeBakey knowing.
Man.
And yeah, I know. Remember,
stole my
no
heart.
FDA. Yeah, literally. Oh, that would have been a great title for that chapter. And this grew into one of the biggest feuds in medical history. I'm not sure there's ever been anything that they were on the cover of Life magazine.
And
hating each other,
and there was even in television, right? Ben Casey was a TV show around the time of Dr. Kildare.
Yes, and yeah, that was sort of the St. Elsewhere of its time.
Grey's Anatomy and
Grey's Anatomy,
ER. But there were these two doctors in there, right? There were two of the characters were fashioned after. The two of them?
Yes, they were fashioned. One was very handsome.
Which one would that be?
Dr. Cooley. Yes. That was Dr. Cooley, who played Ben Casey, and his mentor was Dr. Zorba,
right,
who was a guy who sort of looked like he had stuck his finger in a socket. And the only difference was Dr. Zorba in the TV show was sort of a friendly mentor.
Right.
And DeBakey
right.
probably would have. I think if the phrase "he's dead to me" had been popular at that time, that's how DeBakey would have described Cooley.
But being dead to you wouldn't really stop any of them, right? I mean, they felt almost godlike, right? Okay, so they're just a little bit dead. Let's try to bring them back. And you hear that in your book about they're on the table. There's no pulse. I remember this one case where you talked about the desperation where the person looked like they had died, but they said, go out and get me a sheep heart and I'll put that in.
Yes. That's my favorite story.
Well,
transplants weren't working and there was no artificial heart. And Dr. Cooley, who was the penultimate, ask for forgiveness, not permission guy, turned to somebody, he had a patient literally dying on the table, and he felt there was nothing he could do. And then he had an idea and he turned to somebody and said, go get me a sheep's heart in the lab. And that's what he did.
And so, that did not work out.
It did not work. There's actually a case, which you may remember, called the Baby Faye case, where a doctor subsequently put a baboon heart in a little girl.
Mm-hmm.
So it was at the time, it's sort of shocking to me how little they knew just 40, 50 years ago.
Yeah.
And so they were certainly willing to try anything.
And so they were almost out of step with the technology, right? So they were having to try. It's like trying to build an airplane as it's taking off.
You know, right.
So like, oh, this engine's not quite working. We
That's
are up in the
analogy.
Air here.
Yeah.
Or repair the engine. So then this idea came along about an artificial heart. You know, why bother about rejection? Why not build one? It's just a pump, right? So
right.
Tell me about that arc.
Well, what happened in the beginning, there was debate, or they were like, the artificial heart and the transplanted heart were sort of competitors. And as one stock went down, the other ones would rise. So whenever transplants were failing, then researchers would go back to the artificial heart, and then the transplant would start working, and they'd give up on the artificial heart. But basically, the genesis of the artificial heart is a pump that DeBakey also was invented in DeBakey's lab, which helps the left side of the heart, which is the side of the heart that does the heavy lifting.
And that's the left ventricle, you know, and that's the so-called LVAD, left ventricular assist device.
Yes, I'm a little loath to use the term because I don't want anybody to go to sleep when I'm talking.
No, but that's okay.
okay. Dr. DeBakey put a rudimentary LVAD in a woman in 1963. It was external. It just hung for, she looked like she
outside
had this
of her
normal
body.
Pendulum hanging mm-hmm. outside her body. But she lived and she did well enough that they could take the pump out. Mm-hmm. And she went home and lived for, you know, I think 10 or so more years and then died from a car accident.
Right. And so these things are, I'm sorry to interrupt, but just to explain to the audience that these were felt to be kind of a bridge, right? Get you over mm-hmm. in a period of where your heart's not working very well. Either you recover or maybe it's a bridge to transplantation.
To transplantation.
So that then while they're finding a heart. And the problem, of course, was psychologically, some people went home and they just felt, you know what, this is not living. You talk about that in one of your chapters.
It took a long time, again, to perfect this device. I mean, now the LVAD, Dick Cheney had one.
Mm-hmm.
There
got
people
a transplant
now,
subsequently.
Yeah. There are some people who just now say, I don't even want a transplant. I'm happy with my LVAD. Mm-hmm. And you'll see them walking around. They look like they have shoulder bags. But that's their battery pack that's keeping them alive with the LVAD.
And then this Dr. Jarvik comes along and is a new player.
Right. And a very interesting and somewhat eccentric guy. There had been artificial heart work done before with Cooley putting this stolen heart in a person who lived. But in 82, Jarvik had invented an artificial heart that was put in by a surgeon named William DeVries into the chest of a dentist named Barney Clark, who was dying of heart disease.
Right.
And this was sort of one of the first media circuses where first everyone was glued to their televisions because this man had an artificial heart and he was living day after day. And this was a modern medical miracle. Well, then he started deteriorating and people were still watching their television. So it became this death watch that actually sort of stopped artificial heart work in its tracks for many years after that. I mean, people thought, oh, it doesn't work. This is agony. Why are we even doing this?
Yeah. Now, because we have just a few minutes left, where are we now with the artificial heart? I know that people are coming up with new ideas. Maybe it shouldn't be outside the heart. It should be inside the heart. It should be this way. It should be that way. Where are we now?
The device that I write about, there's several in experimental stages, but this one is almost done with animal trials, and they're hoping to have it in someone, a person, in the next 2 years. And this is an extremely simple device that only has one moving part, which compared to so many of these other ones, which are just fantastically complex. And the most interesting thing about this heart is it doesn't pulse. It just spins. So you would live essentially without a heartbeat unless they decide to build one in for various reasons. They don't.
Like, and one reason for building it in might be if you faint and some person comes and says they don't have a pulse,
Yeah, that's a great idea. Exactly.
No, I mean.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
For real.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Yes.
Unintended consequences.
Unintended consequences. Yes.
So where are we with that device now? Is it coming to a drugstore near you or a hospital near you soon?
A while away. I think we're 2 years away or so from human trials.
But the art's there.
The art is there. It, for many years, they'd have a heart, but they wouldn't have enough to power it for a long time. Then they'd have a power source, but a heart that would wear out too soon. And now they've finally gotten the technology together where they can power it and it won't wear out.
Well, my iPhone won't last. My iPhone battery won't last more than a few hours. So are they going nuclear? How are they doing it with the heart?
Plutonium. That's sort of, which they tried before and there was all this hue and cry, but now they've figured out how to do it that.
For the purposes of people wanting to buy this book, which I found to be really interesting. It's called Ticker, The Quest to Create an Artificial Heart by Mimi Swartz. And it's available now. Is it out?
Yes, it's out. It's at bookstores near you and Amazon, Powell, Barnes & Noble, you name it.
And you tell it in a beautiful way. You might think, oh, my gosh, this is going to be a boring book about hearts and artificial tickers, but you get into the personal life of everybody and it's really interesting. You sort of pull back the lab coat and see what's underneath it. And you do it by using somebody who I haven't mentioned yet, but we'll finish talking about Bud Fraser, Dr. Fraser. Mm-hmm. How do you use him in the book to sort of help tell this story?
He's the through line. He was the protege of both DeBakey and Cooley, and it was his lifelong dream to build an artificial heart. So he started in the early 60s saving lives with his hand. He tells the story of saving a young Italian boy just with keeping his hand in the boy's chest, pumping. And once he was forced to stop by Dr. DeBakey, the boy died, and that sort of formed his thinking. Well, there should be a machine that can do this, but the road to getting there was bumpy with a lot of interesting twists and turns.
And we'll leave it at that, including at the very end, a rapprochement of sorts between Dr. Cooley and Dr. DeBakey, but we'll leave that to the viewer. That'll be our teaser for them to go out and buy this book. But Mimi Swartz, thank you very, very much for talking with me. It was a real pleasure, and there's a lot in this book, so I do suggest people go out and buy it. It's really interesting.
Thank you so much. It was great talking with you.
Likewise.